You're listening to the Study Legal English podcast, helping lawyers and law students become fluent in legal English. For more information, visit studylegalenglish.com.
Hello and welcome to the Study Legal English podcast. Today I've got a special guest on the show. He is a writer, educator, lawyer and artist. He's a graduate from Harvard and Yale law schools and former lecturer at Harvard Law. And he's written quite a few books, especially in the area of writing and legal writing. Some interesting books for listeners would be Writing to Win, The Legal Writer, and The American Way of Writing. So we'll be talking a little bit about my guest's work, legal writing, and whatever else comes up. So welcome to the show, Stephen D. Stark.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Great.
Hello.
Hi. All the way from Boston.
Right.
On Skype today. So thank you. So Stephen, first of all, how did you get to where you are today?
Is that kind of an existential question or in terms of legal writing? Well, I went to law school and I was very interested in the fact that even though lawyers are supposed to be very good communicators, it's part of sort of what they do, a lot of them weren't. And there were certain kind of ticks of the trade that all of them tended to carry that hurt their writing. So I began kind of just informally looking into that. And through that, I started giving a workshop at Harvard Law School. And then I gave a series of workshops, courses there for a number of years, and also taught a special course for the international LLMs. And then from that, I branched out a little bit and started giving courses to practicing lawyers, because in the States and in the UK, as you know, and other places, you're required to take a certain number of continuing legal education hours. And so I started continuing legal education, and I started giving courses for practicing lawyers, both in the States and around the world, literally. So that's sort of how I got into it.
I've read your book, The American Way of Writing. For listeners, it's quite an interesting book because it's split into chapters, which are quite short, quite digestible and to the point. And at the end of each chapter, there's a kind of a recap section, which is really, really helpful. And some chapters that I thought were particularly interesting were the ones on, there was one on legal writing and also writing at work and also writing at school. So, you know, we can talk maybe a little bit about those particular chapters.
Sure.
And your experience in these areas. Why did you write this book? Why did you think it was needed?
Well, when I began teaching internationally to lawyers within companies and within law firms, these are people who have a terrific grasp of English. I mean, a terrific grasp of the law. But what I inevitably found is that there's something elusive about sort of reaching that final stage of being, of sounding like a native, really, in legal English, that's very hard for these people, and I think for anyone to reach. And obviously, traditional courses didn't teach it, and obviously, university courses didn't teach it. So I wanted to write a book that kind of bridged that gap. I mean, part of the problem is, and I'm sure you and your listeners know this, English speakers all are raised, taught, trained in the common law system. The rest of the world uses either a civil system or a religious system or something like that. And learning to write within the common law system is a skill that's harder to master than it seems. I mean, look, we all know the common law is premised on this idea that if two people fight, the truth emerges. I mean, it's kind of a crazy idea because the truth doesn't emerge. The strongest person emerges. But nevertheless, that's what we're stuck with. And therefore, common law writers become very facile at A, learning how to make arguments, and B, they approach, I think, all forms of legal writing as if there's an argument at stake. I mean, even when they give advice to clients, they think of it more kind of in the back of their minds as, well, I want to persuade them to do this. I want to tell them which direction to go rather than another. And again, to non-common law writers, and these are obviously writers in another language, English legal writing seems a little bit off-putting. I mean, it's a little bit in your face. And I think a lot of it comes from this learning to try to master this persuasive edge that civil law writing doesn't have, even in English, when English lawyers do it right. So I think that's part of it. It's also just all languages are unique, but English has got a lot of oddities. It's easy to learn badly, as a scholar once said, but it's very hard to master. When do you use articles? When do you not? Well, the problem is there's no hard and fast rule about that. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. And even between the UK and the States, I mean, you go to hospital, we go to a hospital. There's just learning how to master those is hard, particularly if your language doesn't have them, which Slavic languages don't. And there's a lot of just idiosyncrasies like that that make it hard to master. There's also the culture of each English-speaking country that's kind of the last stage. You need to learn that in order to learn to communicate with people who use that type of English.
Yeah, you kind of give context to the book, The American Way of Writing, with this part at the beginning talking about the American culture. Let's go back to this persuasive idea. Can you give some pointers, like, for how listeners could improve their persuasive writing?
Yeah, I'll give you two suggestions right off the bat. Two ways to be persuasive. First of all, you don't want to back into your conclusion. You want to state the conclusion, support it, and go on to the next point. Many legal writers don't do that. So, for example, if I ask you to recommend a series that I should stream tonight to watch, and why, you know, we're just talking as friends, you'd say, oh, you should go stream Game of Thrones. And the reason is because the plot is intricate, it's got some good people in it, and something like that. That's not the way legal writers tend to write a lot of the time. What they would write is something like, the question I've been asked is, what should I stream tonight and what should I not stream? Streaming was first developed as a device to deliver entertainment in the home marketplace, blah, 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 for 90 pages. And then finally on page 90 through 100, oh, in conclusion, you should stream Game of Thrones and here's why. We can just see when we hear that's a terrible way to make an argument. Now, the question is, why do lawyers tend to do that? It's because almost all English speakers, and it goes beyond English, a lot of educational systems mimic this, are taught to use, when they write, a variant of what's called the Western Scientific Method. And what the Western Scientific Method holds is that your job as a communicator is to lay out all the evidence very objectively, analyze it, and then present your conclusion to the public. And that way your findings aren't predetermined. They're not biased. Well, that makes a lot of sense for science. It makes no sense for argument, because if I back into my conclusion, you're not going to hang around, you know, until I get the point, and you're not going to be persuaded by it. So the way we're traditionally taught to write academically is counter to what makes a good argument. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that in English-speaking cultures, we are very evidence-based. We present factual evidence to support whatever it is that we're doing. So, for example, I mean, it would be your opinion, but when you're trying to persuade me about Game of Thrones and talk about facts, I mean, they're facts in quotes, but, you know, what the actors are like, what they've been in before, who wrote the book. We don't present theory. And the problem for a lot of writers is they present the theory and then the facts. And that's not the way English speakers tend to approach the world. Using facts, or telling a story, for lack of a better term, to bolster your argument is a tried and true English speaker's technique. It's not what non-native speakers tend to feel comfortable with, because that's not the way their systems, their culture tend to operate. So those are two things that come to mind first. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So you also mentioned about the articles, which is just simply a difficult thing, sadly, for non-native speakers to get right. Lots of grammatical irregularities in the English language.
They're idiomatic. English has a lot of things that don't follow strict rules. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The main reason is, and I'll tell a little story that illustrates this. If you go to Russia and ask them who are their greatest writers, they will give you the obvious names. Most of the time, Tolstoy, Pushkin, Gogol, whatever. You ask a group of French people, same thing. I mean, it's different writers, but it's Victor Hugo, Flaubert, Balzac, Proust, or whatever. You ask English speakers, they tend to say Shakespeare, a lot of them. But what's interesting is that Shakespeare wasn't a writer in the way that those other people were. Shakespeare created prose to be heard, not really to be read. I mean, obviously the plays are seen as well as heard, but even the sonnets, poetry, it's created to be heard rather than read. That tells you something very important, not unique, but distinctive about English, which is that in its purest form, it's a spoken language. It's not a written language. There is no high English and low English the way there is high German and low German, or, you know, how it's written and how it's spoken. How it's spoken is what counts. Well, spoken languages, particularly this language, is constantly evolving. It's constantly changing. The rules are constantly changing. And that makes it much more idiomatic than other languages, because what may have been correct 10 minutes ago, being a little facetious, but not much, isn't correct any longer. So the rules are slippery. And that's because the speakers control it in a sense. Anyway, that's one of the big problems.
So, you know, you've mentioned a lot about American culture at the beginning, and it's something that's really important to understand the culture of a country so that you get the tone of your writing correct. I think a lot of the listeners will be writing, letters, but probably emails most of the time, to sometimes Americans. So let's talk a little bit about the culture, because of course there are cultural differences between the British audience and the American. And, you know, most of the time I talk about the British audience. Can you maybe talk a little bit about some of the points of the American culture and how they're different to the British, or how they're important for the writing?
Absolutely. Well, let's take one principal one. Americans are direct to a fault. And these things are measured by social psychologists. They are the second most direct people on the planet. The Dutch are number one. And I'll explain why the difference. But it explains a little bit why New Yorkers are even more direct than Americans are. I mean, the Dutch founded New York. Americans take indirectness as a sign that you may be lying to them. Or they get impatient because you didn't get to the point fast enough. They want to go on and do something else. Other English-speaking cultures, the Australians are the closest to Americans, as are the New Zealanders. But the British and the Canadians are much less direct because they're more polite than Americans, which is a great thing. I'm not knocking it. It's just they are more polite. And they think that to just jump into conversation, to tell somebody what you want right up front, is rude. There's an old New Yorker cartoon, I think it was, about a decade ago, where it showed an American and a British person had fallen into a pond or a lake. And the American is yelling, "Help!" And the British person is saying, "Well, perhaps, do you think you might lend me a hand if it is, you know?" And again, I think the British are less like that than they used to be, particularly in the London and surrounding areas. But that's one of the key differences. So, for example, when you write an email to an American, forget the pleasantries. How you doing? Whatever. You go right to the point because they don't want any pleasantries. Now, you can see how, for example, if you're Japanese, that's a real problem because pleasantries, you know, the exchange of business cards in writing, so to speak. And again, I'm not criticizing Japanese culture, but they're on the opposite end of the spectrum. It's all pleasantries to a certain degree up to a point. And so for them, it runs against their cultural grain to write in the American style, but you have to if you're writing to an American, just as an American should do the opposite when writing to the Japanese, although Americans are very bad at conforming their personal practices to other cultures. There's this old aphorism, what do you call someone who speaks two languages? Bilingual. What do you call someone who speaks one language? American, anyway. Direct and to the point. Now, let me go back to the Dutch. The Dutch are just as direct, But Americans have one exception. They are very indirect when they have to criticize someone because that interferes with their desire to be liked and to be friendly, which is very important to Americans as well. And so they pull their punches, so to speak. The Dutch don't care whether you like them or not. I mean, they're going to tell you exactly what they think, even when they're criticizing you. Interestingly, just to go back to our example, the Japanese are, on this cultural scale, extraordinarily indirect, except when they're criticizing themselves or apologizing. And then they tend to be direct. So anyway, that gives you a sense of sort of where Americans and other people are on the spectrum.
Yeah, talking about the British being polite, it's something that when I read it in your book, I was like, oh, you know, of course it's the stereotype. And I was thinking like, you know, my preference is to be direct, but I understand that that's not the average way. And I've had students who've asked me about like, oh, how do they write a polite email? And they've been really trying to overdo it on the politeness. And I kind of just say, well, to a British audience, you know, if you say at the beginning of an email something like trust all is well and then get to the point, a British lawyer, for example, I think could also appreciate that directness. However, I do also agree with you that the Americans are probably more direct and English people do generally add in the pleases and thank yous and the, you know, could I please whatever.
Yes. And by the way, the Canadians are more polite than the English. In some of these characteristics, they're more English than the English. I mean, there's the obvious ties that still, as a Commonwealth country, that they have that the Americans don't have. So anyway.
Well, Harry and Meghan have just moved there. So
I'll have to learn this.
Yeah. So you've talked a little bit about, you know, lead with your conclusion, be very direct to the point. If we were talking about, say, I don't know, a French lawyer who is writing to an American lawyer, are there any other aspects that you think are important?
Well, let me back up and just explain sort of an overall point and then specifically, because for this, it's not just a French lawyer, although it'll be more difficult for them, but even English-speaking lawyers have trouble with this. Most legal writing now is done by email, I mean, which is a very new innovation. It's only in the last 10 years. And I think the email revolution has probably changed writing in the workplace more than anything else in the last 4 or 5 centuries. I mean, technological changes in the way people communicate changes not only the fashion of communication, it changes the style of communication. In other words, the invention of the printing press, if we go back 5 centuries, changed not only the dissemination of information in the cultures to which it came, it changed the way people actually spoke and the way they wrote. And people actually commented on that at the time. A lot of people complained about it. Well, today, the whole email thing has begun to dramatically change the way particularly English speakers and writers read, but it therefore should change the way we write. And I think English speakers are a little better at this than those on the outside, but they're not particularly great at it either, because, you know, a lot of what they write, even an email, would have been fine for a letter in 1970 or even 1990, but it doesn't fit the way people read email. And I put read in quotes because the idea that they actually read it in the conventional way that we think of reading, I don't think is, I'd start with just me. I mean, social psychologists and people who've studied this, people don't read the way they used to. And so therefore, I would say two quick things. First of all, to go back to our other things, you got to have the key information in the first 2 sentences, because what happens is that people's engagement with the text diminishes the longer they read with email. It's not like a de Maupassant or O. Henry short story where you save the best part to the end. There is no end that people go to. And second, I'd say anything longer than 100 words is probably too long, because as email has evolved, its rules are conforming, and I put rules in quotes because they're always changing, are closer to texting than they are to writing a traditional letter. And I don't think lawyers anywhere, but particularly outside English-speaking cultures, have kind of come to grips with all these sets of issues. And that's a big problem. They just write too much, too long. They don't give the point up first. It's not email writing. It's like they assume people are going to sit down and study it, and nobody does that with email. I mean, nor do they do it with texting. So that's a big problem.
Yeah. And in your book, you give some examples of how to keep your sentences short and things like that. And it's something that I've talked about before on the show, about keeping the active voice, just getting rid of any extra information that doesn't need to be there. So you've got some helpful tips along those lines in the book as well. You also mentioned things like use bullet points. Do you think that using the structure, people can just simply use bullet points if necessary, list things?
Yeah, no, the more white space, the better. The problem with email is it doesn't format very well. See, you may write an email to me with lots of bullet points and paragraphing, but it won't come across that way when I receive it. It'll read like a telegram, you know, just all one paragraph. And that's yet another reason why 100 words is about all you can do, because a lot of the traditional formatting things that we use with the written word don't exist in email. I mean, I'll give you another interesting example from the past. If you look at medieval scrolls, I don't recommend it, but if you read them, there's no paragraphs. It's all just one text. Well, where did paragraphs come from? Came after Gutenberg. I mean, they were setting these things up and said, well, yeah, that's kind of boring on a page. That's hard to read. Let's just kind of break it up some. Well, it's kind of like bullet points or whatever. But email doesn't do that. That's the problem. So maybe it will in the future, and then we'll change what we say. But for now, it's got to be very tight and short, or else you're not going to get it read.
If one kind of email system has bullet points, it doesn't always translate to another email provider. So you've talked obviously about, you know, we should avoid writing long emails. But are there things that could be offensive to an American audience?
Well, first of all, it's hard to offend an American with your directness. We've already talked about that. That's virtually impossible. Well, Americans, and I think they're not alone in this, you know, comments about their country and their politics, they don't take particularly well to from outsiders. I mean, I don't know where that might come in. It's interesting. I think that, and this is wrong, but Americans assume that everyone should speak perfect English and aspires to speak perfect English in a certain way. And so when they see grammatical errors or misspellings, it's not so much that they're offended by it. They just think the writer is unintelligent. And that's obviously not a good thing for the writer to leave that impression. Now, what's interesting is that if you look at this between the British and the Americans, we treat collective nouns differently. An American will say or write, Chelsea is going to win the Champions League. I mean, they're not, but let's just say it. Well, in the English say, Chelsea are going to win the Champions League. And I had this when I lived in England with my kids, and we moved back. My kids were writing in the English style. Well, an American doesn't think, oh, gee, they're using the English style, not the American style. They think, oh, gee, they don't know how to write. Their grammar's bad, because they don't realize there is an English style. So not knowing what Americans do isn't taken by them as a sign of, oh, you just need to learn more about the culture. It's taken as a sign that, you know, that you don't know as much as you should know.
That's probably the difference between British and American perceptions, because from a British perspective, probably because American English is spoken so much and because we see it on television so much, when we see Chelsea is or Chelsea are an uncountable noun, and for us it's like, well, either one is correct. Very often British people don't even realize which is the British one and which is the American. It's just like, use either one. And something that struck me was that you said if people don't write correctly in American, they're seen as unintelligent. Probably that would also be the case in English, but we do have, when non-native English speaking people are writing, there's certainly a leeway. We understand that they're non-native speakers. If you know that the person is foreign, is there any kind of acceptance of it a little bit?
Less than you would think. It's interesting. If Americans, because I also teach speaking skills as well, and what non-native speakers, they often worry about. They say, well, I have an accent. What will the Americans think of that? Well, the accent isn't going to bother them because they realize, oh, they speak with an accent because they come from someplace else, and they expect that. What counts against the speaker are the prejudices that Americans don't know they have that they can't then make allowances for. So, for example, they're not the most on this scale, but American speech patterns are fairly animated. Their voices are fairly animated. When they hear a speaker from Scandinavia or France, just to take two examples. Well, let me put it this way. When an American hears another American who speaks in a monotone, often what they assume subconsciously is, well, they're not interested in it. I'm not going to be either. And it's not that the French and the Scandinavians aren't interested in it. It's just their styles of discourse are much more monotone. But you see, there, Americans can't account for it. Now, the problem with writing is they may know you're in Moscow or Warsaw or Paris or whatever, but they don't read it consciously with this idea, oh, they're international, they have some idiosyncrasies that we don't have. They tend to very quickly judge it subconsciously. See, the thing is, you live, and it's why the British are much better at this. You live within 500 miles of dozens of cultures. You're used to the idea that different people in different places do things. Americans are extraordinarily insular. They live in this place that's quite diverse, at least they think it is, quite large, surrounded on both sides by oceans. They just don't see that much that's different from them. And even to the extent they do, take immigrants, well, they're immigrants to America. They're trying to be more American, most of them, if not all of them. I may be making an excuse for Americans, but they just aren't used to seeing things that aren't part of their daily experience here. And so they're not as good at making allowances as other people are. It's not defensible, but I'm just trying to explain it.
So it's good for listeners to know that really you have to really try and get your English correct, because when you're writing to an American audience, more so than perhaps a British that could be more forgiving of the mistakes, that it's really, really essential that you're getting things right when you're writing to an American audience. Something that I thought could be interesting to speak about as well is the use recently of gender neutral pronouns. Can you explain a little bit about the use of gender neutral pronouns?
Well, in the States, you should be gender neutral as much as possible. And there's a pretty easy way to do that that isn't really noticeable, which is to, first of all, when you speak, just to say he or she or his or her or whatever, you can do it that way. Or you put your sentences as much as you can in the plural, and usually you can, you get around the problem. So if I say, each child must bring his or her shovel to the sandbox, is what you would say. But it's a little awkward to write. But if you say, all children must bring their shovels to the sandbox, it's not exactly the same thing, but it's very close, close enough. So if you take your sentences and change them to the plural, you get to pick a neutral pronoun. Now, people have started to say it's okay to say each child must bring their shovel to the sandbox. I mean, I would put it in the plural. I think it's better to do that just because it's an older, more easier choice, I think, to make.
Yeah. It's certainly, I mean, from the British perspective, it's certainly there, as even a singular pronoun is being used quite a lot. I understand that traditionally it's not grammatically correct, but it seems to be an evolution that is happening in British English. Maybe it's happening a little bit in American English.
Oh, no, it's happening in the States too. The only reason I hesitate is that on the social scale, not the political scale, lawyers are somewhat conservative. I mean, they are not the first to kind of jump into linguistic changes and a lot of other things. So to err on the side of caution with them, with language changes, is probably a good thing to do. I mean, I'll give you another example. In personal email, you can do anything you want. And ending every sentence with an exclamation point. Great to see you. How you doing? I think in work email, I mean, they look sophomoric, like you're 14 years old. You know, great to see you last week, 2 exclamation points. You know, I want to say, what? It wasn't 3 exclamation points? Weren't you really glad to see? I just wouldn't use exclamation points, even though people do. And again, part of it might be social conservatism. I just think it doesn't look serious. I don't think a doctor would write, you know, here's your diagnosis, 2 exclamation points. It's not the right thing to do.
Certainly, it's quite the same in British English as well, although probably it kind of depends on the profession and also the younger audience. Sometimes I've seen, the younger audience and different cultures using exclamation marks in professional emails and even emojis, which for me, when I first received some professional emails with emojis in, I was like, wow, this is like inappropriate. But then I kind of softened to it. And now, you know, I kind of feel that certainly probably sending, you know, a counterpart, serving a claim on a defendant with an emoji smiley face is not the thing to do. However, they are creeping in to even professional emails. I think it will be interesting to see in the future what happens with emojis because they're relatively new. But yeah, certainly I would say don't use them in very professional emails.
Particularly given what lawyers do. I mean, again, I think the analogy to doctors is a pretty good one. To be honest, most of your clients, most of the people you write for, if you're in your 20s, are probably somewhat older. So certainly the clients are, unless you've got Hollywood stars or something like that. I would err on the side of caution and take your clues from what the person writing you is doing.
Absolutely. I have a WhatsApp group with some of my close friends, and we all have quite diverse professions. One of them is a doctor, one of them's an academic, one of them's a nurse. And I asked them, do you use emojis in your emails? And the doctor said, absolutely not. The academic said, occasionally. And the nurse said, yeah, sometimes, but not, absolutely not in professional emails. So it was good to get an idea from those other professions as well. Good. So some very helpful points there, Stephen. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been great.
Good. And for listeners, some key takeaways from today. Remember to be persuasive in your email writing. Make sure that you are concise. You basically can't offend an American by being too direct. So don't be afraid of that. And also, equally, don't feel offended if you get a very direct email from an American. It's simply part of the culture. So, Stephen's book has a lot more detail on this. It is called The American Way of Writing. And I will leave a link to this in the show notes. So, you know, if you're interested in learning a bit more about this, then certainly check it out. And a question for you listeners is, what do you find difficult about writing emails? Let me know. Send me an email to louise@studylegalenglish.com.
Make the email short and to the point. We've learned this.
Very good. Exactly. Short, to the point. Take those good points from Stephen. So thank you, Stephen, again. And thank you for listening. Take care and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Study Legal English podcast. If you really want to get ahead, why not become a member and gain access to many learning resources? Visit studylegalenglish.com/pricing.